This is Ron Stockton.
Back in March 2019, I got a surprising phone call. It was from an editor of the Jewish News, the Detroit paper. She wanted to know if I would be willing to write some thoughts about the link between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. The context was that President Emmanuel Macron of France, who is very pro-Israeli, had met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and had declared that anti-Zionism was a form of anti-Semitism. There had been very inflammatory arguments over this topic, most involving more heat than light, and certainly Netanyahu was not one for cooling down an inflammatory debate. He typically carried a rhetorical gas can around with him just in case he encountered a spark. The question I had to ask myself was whether I could avoid the flames and shed some light on this very difficult topic. I asked the editor how she had gotten my name, and she said I was recommended by a student. Well, that was enough to convince me that I should give it a try, given the fact that I dealt with difficult topics almost every day in class. My standard approach to the situation such as this, as former students would tell you, is to start by defining terms. In the end, the Jewish News did not run the piece, which did not surprise me. I suspect they were worried about blowback. But here's what I wrote. I've been asked my thoughts on a recent statement by President Macron of France that anti-Zionism is, quote, a reinvented form of anti-Semitism. To me, a key question is definition. Anti-Semitism was a term coined in 1879 and used by a German political party of that name. Its goal was to marginalize Jews and keep them from positions of influence in Germany. It was linked to an idea that the Jews were an alien people, inherently different from other Germans. It combined ideology and politics and bizarre views on race, not to mention bigotry. Some contemporary definitions of anti-Semitism have compared strong criticisms of Israel, particularly of its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its policies in those territories, to historic assaults or defamations of Jews. Examples of those past assaults would be the blood libel, that the Jews killed Christ, and the responsibility for that deed rests upon all Jews. There was also the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, alleging that there is a secret organization of Jews whose goal is to undermine Western civilization so they can control the world. I've seen some cases where I might agree that criticisms of Israel seem to parallel traditional anti-Semitism, but not many. On the broader issue, according to a 2013 Pew Research study, 89% of all Jews are okay with what they consider strong criticisms of Israel. For someone to say we should not buy goods produced on the West Bank settlements, or I will not write a letter for a student going to an Israeli program that admits only Jews, or our university or church should sell its shares in Caterpillar until it can assure us that their machines will not be used to support the West Bank settlements, is not the same as saying Jews should not be allowed to hold public office, or that Jews are inherently evil, or that malevolent Jews control the world. Israel is a powerful state. Nasty words or harsh criticisms will not bring it down. Moreover, many top Israeli military and security officials feel that the major threat to Israel's future is that it's trying to keep over 3 million subject people under its control. It may sting to hear someone criticize Israel's West Bank policies as apartheid or racism, or to read a report concluding that its military strikes into Gaza are disproportionate force or war crimes. But these are political criticisms and are not the same as saying that Israel should be destroyed as a state or that Jews are inherently evil. A statement that anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism also presents practical problems, given that there is no agreed-upon definition of Zionism. In the 1950s, David Ben-Gurion, the founding father of Israel, would berate American Jews for calling themselves Zionists. He said that Zionism was a movement to get Jews to return to Israel, and that those living in America should not even call themselves Zionists. Likewise, when contemporary groups say Jews should put Israel at the center of their identity, they encounter real resistance from those who identify whose identity centers on Jewish religion, 12%, according to Pew, or living a righteous life, 69%, or honoring the powerful ethical traditions of social justice, 56%. In terms of public opinion, if we ask Jews whether they consider themselves Zionists, only a minority do. And of those who say yes, they're all over the place in terms of what they mean. Israel should be safe and secure, okay? Or if Jews are at risk, they should have a place to go, okay? Ben-Gurion would agree with these sentiments, but that is not what he meant by Zionism. Moreover, if we go back to Herzl, the founder of modern political Zionism, he had his own perspective. In his famous 1896 pamphlet, Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, he argued that Jews were not just a religious or an ethnic group, but were a national people living in temporary exile and awaiting a return to their homeland. For those interested, I have a podcast on Herzl. Ben-Gurion would probably like Herzl's definition, but it would leave out those American Jews who are happy with their American identity and do not consider their lives here to be an exile. I've heard people say that Zionism is the right of Jews to live in their own state. But what does that even mean? By definition, a state is a set of institutions of coercion and control. Does this mean that Israel is a Jewish state, the Netanyahu position, rather than a state of the Jewish people with full and equal rights for all its people, to borrow from the Israeli Declaration of Independence? When President Macron said, with Benjamin Netanyahu at his side, that anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, he made his guest happy. But he was taking sides in an internal debate, and the reality is far more complex than the rhetoric. Perhaps it lies in the well-known saying that if you have two Jews, you will have three opinions. Okay, that was the essay. Now I want to discuss some additional points on Zionism, whatever that means. First, Arabs will often say, we are opposed to Zionism, we are not opposed to Jews. I've heard this many times. To many skeptics, this is a cynical ploy to let them escape from being exposed as what they are. That suspicion may be justified in a few cases, but I think most people who say that mean it. I know too many examples of Arab-Jewish friendships among my students and colleagues and friends to dismiss those as not sincere. And I saw how my Arab students went gaga over Bernie Sanders, a Brooklyn Jew, when he came to Dearborn in 2016 and then again in 2020. The real question is what such people mean by Zionist. I think most of them mean association with the positions and rhetoric of the Israeli right wing. Consider what happens when someone supporting the Palestinians criticizes the occupation or suggests nonviolent resistance to it through boycotts or other measures. What is the response? Is it to call this anti-Semitism, or to suggest that it is an effort to destroy the state of Israel, or to argue that the Palestinians brought it upon themselves by declining the generous offer offered by the Israelis to create a Palestinian state? Or do they say that Arab regimes are abusive and why do you pick on Israel? If so, then such a person is often considered a Zionist. If you're a public figure and are associated with organizations that make these arguments, you would also be included in that category. These are political considerations based on words and actions. They can apply to Jews and non-Jews. They are not inherently anti-Semitic. There's a second example that I want to mention. It is from Philip Roth's novel, Operation Shylock. Roth was one of America's greatest writers. I've read many of his books. They twist and bend and make the reader think. This book is among the ones that bend the most. This is his second book about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first was The Counterlife. In that book, his character, Zuckerman, a critic of the settlements, goes to Israel to visit his brother, Henry, a right-wing settler. That book was fascinating because Roth allows each party to speak in a persuasive voice. When Zuckerman speaks, you realize how destructive the settlements are. When Henry speaks, you think, those are really good points. I like that. The key character in Operation Shylock is a famous novelist named Philip Roth. He is just recovering from a mental breakdown caused by a reaction to a soon-to-be-banned prescription drug. He is visiting Jerusalem when he discovers that there is another person called Philip Roth who is in the city. That second Roth looks like the author and is giving interviews and being received by prominent people, including the heroic Polish leader Lech Walesa. He is advocating what he calls diasporaism. This is the opposite of Zionism, and he calls himself a reverse Herzl. Herzl, mentioned above, was the Vienna Jew whose famous essay, Der Judenstaat, the Jewish state, is considered the origin of modern political Zionism. It called for the Jews to leave Europe and to create their own state. The fake Roth is arguing that what we know as Jewish civilization is really a European phenomenon. Israel has wrecked it with its militarism, its occupation of Palestinian lands, and its oppression of the Palestinian people. Israel's future is dire. Either it will face another Holocaust, this time at the hands of its Arab neighbors, or it will use nuclear weapons against those neighbors and will destroy its credibility as a state worthy of respect or even continuation. The fake Roth believes that salvation lies in persuading the European Jews, the Ashkenazis, to return to Europe. A million could return to Poland, others to Germany, Austria, Romania, Ukraine, etc. Not only would this put them where they belong, but it would shift the demographic balance in Israel. The reduced population would make it possible to impossible to sustain the occupation. Moreover, the remaining Jews, the Arab world Jews, called Sephardic or Mizrahi or Eastern Jews, who are currently half of the Jewish population, would become a strong majority. They would be able to work out a settlement with the Palestinians, allowing them to have their own state. The novel's real Roth, a vigorous critic of Israeli policies and its leaders, is contemptuous of this bizarre idea. At a certain point, the real Roth meets an Arab friend from graduate school, George Ziad. It turns out that the friend is not an Egyptian, as he had told everyone at the university, but is a Palestinian whose family were 1948 refugees. Now he is back in Palestine, having recovered his Palestinian identity. Roth visits the family in Ramallah. When the night arrives, George calls a taxi driver to take Roth back to his Jerusalem hotel, using the back roads to avoid the Israeli checkpoints. The taxi is a broken-down vehicle, and the driver is also old and broken down. As they ride into the night, the taxi driver says to Roth, "Well, let's let Roth tell it. Are you a Zionist? I'm an old friend of Mr. Ziad. Are you a Zionist?" Roth thinks, "Who is this guy?" and remains silent. "Are you a Zionist? Tell me, what do you mean by Zionist, and I'll tell you if I'm a Zionist. Are you a Zionist? Look, what business is it of yours? Drive, please. This is the road to Jerusalem, is it not? Are you a Zionist?" The car begins to slow down in the pitch darkness. "Why are you slowing down?" "Bad car, no work." "It was working a few minutes ago. Are you a Zionist?" Shift the car down and give it some gas." The car stops completely. "What's going on?" The driver gets out of the car with a flashlight, which he keeps clicking on and off as he walks into the darkness. "Answer me. Why are you stopping out here like this? Where are we? Why are you flashing that light?" Roth shouts into the darkness, "Look, did you understand me? I'm George Ziad's friend." Roth begins to remember all the people who had told him to stay home. "There was an insurrection going on," they said. He realizes now that they were right. Hey, you, where are you?" Roth sees that the keys are still in the car. He starts it and begins to drive, but then sees the driver on the road pulling up his pants. The driver gets into the car. "Sick, stomach." "You should have told me that. I misunderstood." "Are you a Zionist?" "Why do you keep asking this? If you mean Meir Kahana, then I'm not a Zionist." Kahana was the ultra-violent rabbi, then a member of parliament. He was later assassinated in New York. "If you mean Shimon Peres," Roth pauses without finishing the sentence. Peres was the more moderate leader of the Labor Party. "Drive, please. Jerusalem. Just get me to Jerusalem, and without talking. A couple of miles on, the driver stops the car once again and gets out, leaving it in the darkness. Roth sits calmly, laughing at himself at how he had overreacted earlier. Roth reports what happened next. Suddenly, I was blinded by headlights barreling straight towards the taxi. Just inches from the bumper, the other vehicle stopped, although I had braced myself for the impact and may even have begun to scream. Then there was noise everywhere, people shouting, a second vehicle, a third. There was a burst of light, whitening everything, then a second burst, and I was dragged out of the car and onto the road. I don't even know what language I was hearing. I didn't know what to fear more, to have fallen into the violent hands of marauding Arabs or a violent band of Israeli settlers. I was doubled over the car fender. Then I was yanked and spun around and something knocked glancingly against the back of my skull. And then I saw hovering enormously overhead a helicopter. And I found myself shouting, "Don't hit me, goddammit, I'm a Jew!" Did the character Roth finally answer the question? Is this Roth, the author of the book, telling us what Zionism is? Forget definitions. When you're at risk, it is good to have armed Jews around to protect you. As the character Roth puts it, these were just the people I was looking for to get me back to my hotel. Even a conversation with the commander of the unit, traumatized by the deeds he and his men have been committing upon the Palestinians, does not seem to affect him. I've seen this reaction before, by the way. Once I led a delegation of professors on a program to Jerusalem during the ultra-violent Second Intifada. By the end of that three-year conflict, there were over 4,000 dead Palestinians and over 1,000 dead Jews. We had wanted to go to Hebron, but it had been closed for weeks on end. Suddenly it opened. I told the group that we would meet the settler leader and some Palestinians in that conflict-torn city, but this was a war zone, and no one should feel obligated to go. Of course, everyone went. We walked through the open-air market and saw a settler with vegetables in one hand and an Uzi in the other. One of our colleagues had been a Marine drill sergeant. "Do you see that?" he asked. "That man has a safety off and his fingers on the trigger. I always told my recruits that you never turn the safety off unless you think you might have to use your weapon, and you never put your finger on the trigger unless you are preparing to kill someone." And this was in the marketplace. Soon we were walking down a street where settlers, among the most violent in the West Bank, lived in the midst of the Palestinian population. Some Palestinian young men were walking down the street. There was a single Israeli soldier, absent-mindedly kicking rocks and looking bored. I realized that he was not bored at all. He was our security. The danger to us was extremely low. Nobody was going to attack a delegation of middle-aged professors. But at the same time, I realized that if we were attacked, he would be there. I was offended by the military occupation, but at that moment, I was somehow comforted by the presence of that soldier. Maybe this gives us an idea of how people think. When you are at risk, you're happy to have armed, sometimes brutal people there to back you up. Suddenly, I understood something. Thanks for listening. I hope this has provoked you a little.